is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
I don't look at shooting percentage. I couldn't tell you what our three-point percentage was. I know that we led the nation in attempts, which I'm very thankful for that. To me, if you want to invest in shooting and you want your players to do that, then you have to have a style of play that they believe it'll actually happen.
Matt Samen is the head boys basketball coach at Grapevine Faith High School in Texas. Matt recently released his book titled The Leftovers, Basketball, Betrayal, Baylor, and Beyond, describing his journey to college athletics. The book is a remarkable story of personal loss, tragedy, and perseverance through his senior season at Baylor University. Matt's teams at Grapevine Faith High School have become well known for their offensive accomplishments, including leading the nation in three-point field goals made each of the last 2 years. Matt was a three-year letterman at the Colony High School in the Colony, Texas, where he played under head coach Tommy Thomas. He was also a two-year team MVP, elected honorable mention All-USA by USA Today, and a McDonald's All-American nominee as a senior. After his high school career, Matt signed a scholarship with Baylor University, where he played all 4 years. While playing at Baylor, he set the record for most games played in Baylor history, 118. After college, Matt played professionally in Iceland.
Hey Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, everyone. This is Liz Kay, head girls basketball coach at Wacona High School in Dalton, Massachusetts, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly. Mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Coach, do you struggle with building a championship culture, getting your players to communicate on the court, maximizing your practice time, and bringing out the best in all your players? We all struggle in at least a few of these areas, and that's why over 1,500 coaches a year from all levels of play attend a summer or fall PGC course to learn these things. And coaches consistently say spending a week at PGC is the most useful and beneficial investment they've ever made in their coaching career. At your PGC course, you'll attend all the classroom, video, and court sessions, just like the players. If you're ready to take your coaching and your team to new heights next season, go to pgcbasketball.com, find a summer or fall course near you, and sign up. That's pgcbasketball.com. Get ready to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Matt Samen, head boys basketball coach at Grapevine Faith High School in the state of Texas.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, but I am pleased to be joined by Matt Samen, the head boys basketball coach at Grapevine Faith High School. Matt, welcome to the Hoopheads Pod.
Hey, Mike, thanks so much for having me on, man.
Excited to have you on. Looking forward to being able to dive into all of the interesting things that you've been able to do throughout your basketball life from your time as a player, coach, an author, a podcast host. Man, there is a ton of different directions we're going to go with you tonight, Matt. So let's start, though, by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about your earliest memories of the game of basketball.
I grew up in northeastern PA and played a bunch of sports as a young kid. I think I was 9 years old, though, when I went to a individual skills session in the Pocono Mountains with a guy named Coach John. And Coach John had this, you would have loved it, man. It was this little oasis up in the mountains, asphalt slab with 6 goals on it. And he just ran camps and did skills up there in that area. And he was the first one. Playing basketball as a young kid, I was more on the floor than on my feet and more of a hustler, but no skill. And at 9 years old, though, I was very fortunate to meet him. And he taught me more of a step-by-step process to acquire new skills and to improve as a player. And he would give me homework, which I thought that's something I've carried on with me, even if I ever do skills or with coaching. I always want to make sure I'm giving players things that they can actually take home and do, or else it's not magic. And the 30 or 40 minutes they spend with me isn't enough. And Coach John understood that. And so he would give me things to do from the workout that we had. And I came back and I had to have those things mastered before we could move on. And he also helped me with my goal setting too. So that 9 years old is really when basketball became the main thing, even as I continue to play some other sports, which I think kids should do, especially through elementary school and junior high. Not sure we want to go down that rabbit hole though.
Yeah, we can go down that quick. It's a topic that we talk about a lot on here when you think about multiple sports and you think about the way the system is set up today, that in so many ways it discourages kids, unfortunately, from playing multiple sports, because you just have this drive from one, I think, private business that drives because of money and people needing to get kids into their program. So you have that piece of it. And then I think you also have the pressure on the other side with parents who see other families, other kids doing things. They're like, oh man, we got to do that or we just can't make it. Or you have those parents that are having those conversations.
Yeah.
Like, well, if you want to play on the high school team, you got to be doing this and you got to be on this club team. You got to be playing here and doing this. And I think people, I've said over and over again on the podcast, that to me, one of the most important things that I think we need to do a better job of is just educating parents on what the youth sports landscape should look like and what they should be trying to experience as they go through that process. Because to me, it always feels like people are so focused on what's next that they forget about the joy of what's right in front of them. And that to me is the biggest danger.
Yeah, the big danger is the kids forgetting why they started to play in the first place. I mean, we all started to play because it was just so much fun to throw that round ball through that hoop. And we felt that joy when that happened. And then we learned how to compete with others. And you nailed it though, man. It's that fear of, I see it as a high school coach and teacher, the fear of being left out. It's real for our kids, but I think it's real for parents too. And when they hear what other people are doing, they start to have that conversation. Man, is this something that we should be doing? I feel like it takes a really strong parent nowadays to pump the brakes and say, you know what? I know that's what you all are doing, but that's not what we're going to do. We're going to allow him or her to play everything and have fun. I don't know. I know a little bit about your playing background. It seemed like you were a pretty darn good player in high school and college. But, you know, guys like us maybe were rare. I knew at 9 what I wanted to do. And even though I was playing other sports, I was never putting basketball down. And it really, what it allowed me to do was just solidify that feeling of, you know what? I played baseball. I couldn't hit. I was horrible at hitting. And so I'm going to let that one go. Played football, got hit in the head hard one time. And I thought, you know what? This isn't for me anymore. 7th grade, I can still remember the moment. Swam all the way up through 8th grade when I realized, you know what? This Speedo doesn't fit the way that I wanted to. And I hate this, but you know, my parents would never let me quit, but I got to experience that. And like I said, solidify more that basketball is the way for me. And it's what I love to do. And I just think so many kids now, it's almost like they're not even having the chance to truly choose the one that they love to do and want to do because the other options are almost taken away.
Yeah. If you want to get quote unquote serious with one sport, those other ones really have to fall away. Not because like you experienced those seminal moments that drove you away from those other sports. And I had a couple of those myself. I remember baseball, played baseball up till I was maybe 11 or 12. And the year they were going to curveballs, I'm like, I'm done. I'm out. No curveballs for me.
That thing's coming right for me.
Yeah. I'm like, I do not want to hit the curveball. And then the last sport I gave up before I went exclusively all basketball was tennis. And I was a pretty decent tennis player. And I played with some pretty decent players. And I remember one day I went to my tennis lesson and the tennis instructors had built this, for lack of a better way of saying it, looked like a doorway, and it had been built out of like PVC pipe, and you had to stand in this doorway in your ready position at the net. So you were going to volley, and you had to step forward and make sure that your racket was going forward. You couldn't take your racket back because it would hit the doorway. It would hit that PVC pipe. Okay. Like that was like the frame of a doorway. And I remember after that lesson, I went home and I told my mom and dad, and I said, I don't want to hit tennis balls out of a doorway. I'm done. Like, I like tennis. I like playing, but I don't want this as a tennis career. I'm not interested in doing this in order to be a good tennis player. Whereas with basketball, you could have thrown whatever. You could build doorways around me or whatever you wanted to do. And I would have said, yeah, let's do more of that. Whatever you tell me it's going to help me with my basketball, I would have done it. And I didn't feel that way about those other sports. And I think kids today, unfortunately, they're oftentimes not making that choice for themselves, or often kind of being dictated to, whether it's by their travel coach or organization saying, hey, if you don't join us year round, or you're not playing here or there, then you can't participate in this way. Or it's the parents saying, look, little Johnny over here down the street is doing that. And if you want to play on the high school team eventually, then you got to try to keep up with little Johnny. And the kids end up not being at the center of that decision-making process. And I think that's where we get into a lot of trouble.
Yeah. And even though I feel like I'm a product of specialization, like I'm not anti that. I'm just for it at the right time. And I think that's what's happening now, is that they're focusing so early on that by the time that it would be appropriate for them to specialize, they're kind of done. They're over it. And then now what? And then another whole part of this too is, what is the main thing? I mean, are sports the main thing, or is it just a vehicle to, you know, maybe get what you want in life? For me, it was a college scholarship, but it can't be what your foundation is in. And that ended up getting me in trouble kind of later on in life.
I think it's easy to look at the situation with a lot of kids and think to yourself that where they are in the given moment in their sports career is not being driven by the kid, but it's being driven by the parent. And I always say that's where you get in trouble. When it's driven by the kid, if the kid says at age 8 or 9, I only want to play basketball and I love basketball and this is what I want to do, or I love soccer, I love the violin, or whatever it is, then if it's kid-driven, great. The problem becomes when it's adult-driven and the adults are the one making those decisions. I think that's when we really get into trouble, and then we're not doing a great service to our kids. So it sounds like you and I are pretty similar in that respect. Yeah. That you got to a certain point that, hey, you're playing everything and you're in the backyard or you're on the playground or you're out in the driveway, whatever, and you're trying all these different sports. And eventually you settle on basketball. So once you settle on basketball, you're working with Coach John. What's your process like? Let's fast forward sort of to high school. What's your process like for becoming a better player? How are you balancing out playing pickup games versus I'm working on my game by myself? Just what is your routine? What did your practice routine look like for trying to improve as a player?
Yeah, that's really good. And just one thing you said about the players driving the decision-making, I think then it's really a fun opportunity for parents to be able to fully get behind their child who has a dream, and not just saying it, but actually doing it and having the and showing them and having those habits. So that's what happened for me is a young age, and thankfully because of the parents I had and the coaches that I was able to be around at a young age, I had a realistic plan. You know, Coach John helped me with three goals. This is all as a 9 and 10 year old. I wanted to make my freshman A team. I wanted to make varsity as a sophomore, and I wanted to get a Division I scholarship. Whenever I talk with players, that's the one that I wish I could go back and maybe have some guidance in. I wouldn't just have that D1 word there. I would just college scholarship, and then I would be okay at any level that happening. You know, there's a D3, D2, NAI. There's just great programs out there, and I think maybe because I had that label on that goal, I maybe had some blinders on because I realized, you know, later on getting to Baylor that probably wasn't the right level for me. They were too big, too athletic, and I just had to scrap and scrape. But by the same token, let me ask you this,
because I think this is something that I'm guessing that, you know, you're obviously playing, Baylor's one step up from the level that I played at a mid-major at Kent State. But I felt like I was sort of a Division I or bus kid. And I've tried to do a really good job on the podcast of making sure that people understand that the path that I took, I was kind of lucky because really I was pretty naive about what I was doing and whatever. But I felt like, so the offer that I got at Kent was the only one that I had. And that probably should have told me something that, hey man, most people out there most college coaches don't think that you're a Division I player. But of course, as a kid, you have it in your mind that you are a Division I player. And I saw guys that I played against all the time that I thought I was as good or better than that were signing and going different places. And so you kind of had this stubborn streak in your head of, hey, I'm going to do it. And I think my point is that I would have a really, really hard time telling a kid that, hey man, if you have a dream of playing Division I and you get one offer, I would have a hard time telling that kid, turn it down if that's what your dream has been. And yet at the same time, I also have had many conversations with coaches where I think this is the point that you were about to get to, which is you have to find the right fit. And obviously we can get into what happened to you at Baylor and all, I mean, just the craziness that went on while you were there. But you just think about if you get the right fit, you get the right coach, you get the right teammates, you get the right school, it can all come together and it can be great no matter what level it is. Because ultimately, the reality is no one really cares what level you play at except maybe you and one or two of your buddies and maybe your mom and dad. And beyond that, nobody cares. Nobody cares.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think we all want to, I don't care what we're talking about or what we're doing, we all want to feel valued. And we also want to feel like we're bringing value, that we're enhancing this place. And I think you're right. Like, it doesn't matter what level of play that you're at. Can you make that place better? Do you feel valued by them? And I think those are really good questions to answer, you know, while you're there, while you're having those meetings with coaches, when you're seeing the types of teams and players and the system that they run. You know, do you like that university? You're not just blinded by this is the biggest school, the most prestigious playing in the biggest league that I can get to. So I think it's a good point that you had.
Yeah, it's a challenge because as a 17 or 18 year old, we don't always have the wisdom that we have when we get older. And I know that a lot of kids, although I think it's different today in that there's more information certainly out there today.
Definitely more.
That kids can access in terms of what's realistic for you and you can get more feedback and it's a lot easier. Whereas I was a junior and I've told this story a couple times on the podcast, but Kent State asked me in my summer of my junior year, hey, why don't you come down for an official visit? We want to take you out and do all the things that you get to do on an official visit. And I told them, I only get five of these and I'm pretty sure that Ohio State, Duke, and Carolina are going to want to have me come in, you know, after my senior year. So I think I'm going to pass on that official visit. My mom and I drove down and, you know, paid for our own Wendy's lunch and walked around the campus with the coaches. And let's put it this way, looking back on it, they were less than enthusiastic to have me down there as an unofficial visit. They're like, man, you are a borderline kid who I don't even know if we would offer you a scholarship anyway.
Now you're telling, I think he is.
Exactly. So it's just, you know, you look at it, but I didn't know. My parents didn't know. My high school coach had never had a kid that kind of was at my level, so he didn't know. And as a result, you just kind of do goofy things. I think it's easier to avoid that today, although maybe it's worse because maybe you have so many people that aren't telling you the truth that just are pumping you up to keep you around or whatever. So I don't know. It's interesting. It's hard to know how to look at that.
I definitely think even though there's advantages today in all the information that you can have and how easy it is to talk to people. And because when you and I went through, I mean, texting really wasn't even a thing. Like you weren't going to receive a text. Definitely wasn't social media. So it just I'm guessing for you. I'm not that sure of you about your age, but I'm guessing. And so, I think those parts make it easier, but then it's also harder now because I just don't know how many people are telling the truth, are willing to tell someone exactly the level or places where they need to go or where they don't need to go. Because that's just not a popular thing to do. It's easier to sugarcoat. It's easier not to hurt or crush feelings. But if you're speaking in truth and love to somebody, it may be a difficult conversation. So I think I don't know. It might have been easier when we went through because you would know pretty quick if nobody's calling me. Yeah, that's it. Where now it's just there's so many places, so many ways where I mean there's literally websites that claim that they'll find you a place, you know, and so it's just harder now.
Yeah, it's funny. My son, he's a sophomore this year. He was a sophomore this past year. He'll be a junior next year, and he's always been a very average player. And in the last year and a half, he's kind of caught the bug and he's gotten a lot better and he's improved. And we had never kind of gone out on the travel AAU circuit. He had been stuck playing for his dad and we played locally and our team was okay, not great, not terrible, just okay. And it couldn't have been, the team couldn't have been much better than okay because he wouldn't have played on it. And now he's getting to the point where he's a little bit better. He's 6'5", almost 6'6", and doing some good things out on the basketball floor. So we played with a better AAU team this year. And we go out, we're traveling, go to a couple of different places, and we're based here out of Cleveland, Ohio. And turned out that the group that we got connected to with NAC basketball, really good program, really good coach, really great kids on this team, and we've had quite a bit of success. And my son, I wasn't with him at this tournament because I was coaching my sixth grade daughter, and my wife was with him, and they played in a tournament in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And so I talked to him a couple of times while he was there, and he's like, Dad, I'm just not playing very well. Things aren't going the way, you know, the way that I'd hoped. I'm just not playing as well as, you know, I think I'm capable of. And then he came home, and to your point, there was somebody had seen him in one game, you know, one of these whatever scouting services, and got him a little nice little write up or paragraph, you know, talked about his kid's got a high motor and he's a really good offensive rebounder and all these things. And I'm like, hey, I go, look, I don't know what you were judging yourself on, but this one game, somebody saw something that you liked, and here was a kid who said he thought, he's like, Dad, this is the worst, you know, this is the worst I've played. He's like, why are they writing about me? I'm like, I don't know, but somebody saw something they liked. So you just got to take it with a grain of salt. And it's interesting just the way all this kind of fits together when you think about the process of AAU basketball and scouting and making decisions about where you're going to go to school and if you're going to get an opportunity. And it's really, you have to be very vigilant. I think as a parent, I'm sure you as a high school coach, you have to be very vigilant about helping your players decipher what's the truth and what's not the truth.
Yeah, because if not, you're just hoping to be lucky. You're hoping that I just luck out and have the right people looking out for me and in my ear. And man, hope is just a horrible plan. And I think so many people are hoping that this person that I'm paying is telling me the truth. And that's where I do still see value in the high school coach.
Yep.
As them being a part of the process. Not we don't have to be in control of the whole thing. I think Select Ball definitely has just such a huge piece to it now. And there are some great coaches out there that do that. But the high school coach still has value in, you know what, listen, I just love you as a player, as a person, and I want the best for you. I have no other agenda involved here. You don't pay me to tell you these things. And so I think that there's value where hopefully parents are starting to, as they're playing out here, they're using these other services. They're circling back almost like a true north, you know, to their high school coach for help.
How do you look at your relationship with those AAU select team coaches? If you could design that relationship, or you think about where your players go to play when they're not with you, in an ideal world, what would that look like to you?
Well, to me, it's a partnership. And this is 40-year-old me talking, not 25-year-old me, who used to unfortunately say things like, I have to reteach you after playing summer ball, after playing select ball. I have to break you of all of your bad habits now. I mean, it was so territorial of like, you're my player, not theirs, and they can't claim you. And so getting past all of that garbage, it really needs to be a partnership. I think the worst thing that can happen is that the player ends up feeling some type of friction or pressure from either of us. So I've taken steps with my spring at Grapevine Faith. My belief is that on our last game of the season, Faith basketball ends for all these players. And they have their new season begins, and it's select ball season, which means I'm going to become a supplement to whatever those select coaches are doing. As far as what do my players need right now? They don't need to be working on our defense for an 11-month away season. They don't need to do that. They don't need to run more to get in shape for a season that's 11 months away at Grapevine Faith. They're running a ton right now. So what do they need? They probably need skill work. They probably need to get a ton of purposeful shots up at the right speed with the right mentality. They probably need to stay strong, so we'll get in the weight room for sure, and flexible, so we'll do yoga. And then on Mondays and Fridays, they may be either coming off of a tournament where they played 8 games, or they may be going 2-1. So I'm not going to kill them either. So we're going to have an open environment where, what do you need? You need to get on the gun? You want to make sure your free throws are great for this? You feel right? Or maybe you missed a ton, so you want to get on the gun and shoot 500 of them? This is your time to do that. Oh, you're worn out. You're a little banged up. Man, let's foam roll. Let me get you some ice. And so I've kind of taken that approach to it. And also not doing anything with my high school team. And this is, you may get some high school coaches that click off right here, but we don't do summer league. We don't do spring league. Because I used to do that, but my players would say, well, coach, we've got select practice. What do? That's friction that I don't want them to feel. So spring league's frustrating for me. I can't coach them. We're not really practicing. It's a bunch of guys that really haven't played together, but yet I'm trying to hold them to some unrealistic standard of what Faith basketball is. And so I ask myself, why am I even doing this? Well, it's because my high school coach did it. We did it, and every other coach does it. It's just like those parents that we talked about at the beginning that are, oh, what about, well, look what they're doing. No. What's best for my players? What I feel like it is creating a program where, all right, you need to go be playing select ball because if to be a good high school player now, because it's not really select anymore like you and I played, where you were selected from a group to play on a team. Everybody plays. And if you're not, you're running the risk of not getting as many trips up and down the floor, which can lead to experience, which can lead to more skill. And so you need to be doing that. If you want to play college, I just don't know how you do it without select ball these days. So all that being said, the more kids I have at my small private school playing spring and summer ball, the better. But they won't do it with the academic pressures at Faith and all the other things that, because I still want them to be high school kids, they won't do it if they feel like there are expectations at Grapevine Faith. So I apologize for just going ranting and raving right there, but I don't know. It just struck a nerve.
Well, I think it's interesting to hear you talk about that, because I think that's a dilemma that here in the state of Ohio, the rules used to be you would get 10 days of off-season coaching, and those 10 days pretty much came in June. And then otherwise, you could open up the gym and just have the kids playing in an open gym setting where you couldn't coach. You could really only coach for 10 days. And the rules, when the pandemic hit, it basically opened up where it went from you could do 10 days to in June and July, you could pretty much do 24/7, you know, every day of the week if you wanted to. And so I think a lot of coaches struggled with, well, what's the right amount to do during those times when you have this unfettered access to your players? To your point, how much do you do? And I've talked to lots of different coaches that a lot of times they're running something for their high school program, and yet some of their players have AAU practice, or they have AAU games, or there's this kind of back and forth during the springtime. And then here in Ohio, at least June is kind of dedicated mostly to, there's some AAU stuff going on, but it's mostly dedicated to high school play and being with your high school team. And then July, it shifts back to AAU, although the high schools are still doing things because now they're allowed to. It's an interesting dilemma. And to hear your perspective of, hey, what I'm there now to do is supplement those select coaches and what they're doing and trying to give the kids what they need. I think that goes back to what we talked about earlier, right? That your job as the high school coach is to do what's best for your kids and to try to, obviously you want to help your program and that's important to you. And
yeah, but to me, it goes hand in hand. Yeah, right. It goes hand in hand because, you know, during the what's happening now in Texas is some of the select programs are racing to field teams and create teams. They're starting to creep into February and January now where, you know, you'll see, I follow a lot of them on social media. You'll see a post, hey, open tryouts this Sunday. And I'm like, man, it's late January. We're in district play. You know, so they're creeping in on our time. And that does just fire me up. And so I'll let my guys know, I don't want you doing these things. But there are some programs that they do it in a good way of, we're just going to do skill work, you know, and we're not going to go against each other, which I feel like that might be a little lip service. Like they're just telling me that because what are the odds you get all these dudes in the gym and they don't play? But, you know, I feel like that. So that feeling I get when they do that, because we want them to stay away from our player. This is school season. This is sacred. Don't you do – well, then during their time, what do? We say, listen, I know you've got all this stuff, but we're going to do open gyms after school every day, and we're going to play spring league. So you make it work with your schedule, fit everything else. Like, I don't know. It just seems like how can we have it both ways when I think we can all – most people can acknowledge – I mean, select ball, there's a lot of good to it. And there's a lot of, I mean, it's where I got seen. I played at the Colony High School for Tommy Thomas in DFW. Darren Williams played there. He was a sophomore and I was a senior. And so we had a lot of fun, but like, I didn't get seen at the Colony. I got seen for the Fort Worth Lions at UNT at the Gasso down here. You know, I threw a behind the neck pass and thankfully a Baylor coach was sitting there watching one of my teammates and started watching me a little bit. Like, so if that happened back in the day, it's still the same now. And so I think we need to, and I mean, mental health is such a big thing. Like, I think we need to make it hard on our players when it's necessary and for the right reasons. Like, I need to hold my guys' feet to the fire during our season. Other than that, I don't need to put negative pressure on them that's unnecessary. And I don't need to use coach speak or passive aggressive talk to get them to do things that I feel like, you know, that I would have done or maybe they should do because – I want them playing and I want them to enjoy it. And if they have those dreams and goals, I want to be there to help them achieve it. And I'm such a believer in skill work that I think that I will send the best version of my player to those select teams if I do it right.
I think if you're doing whatever it is that you're doing as a high school coach, as a select coach, as an AAU coach, to look out for the best interest of the player, that you're going to end up making a lot of good decisions if you think about it from the player perspective and how you can help the player ultimately get better. And let's face it, we all like to put a ton of importance on coaching and X's and O's and drawing things up and practice design and which kind of drills we do and how competitive we are. We use small-sided games. But ultimately, if you have more skilled players, that's usually what wins. And yeah, coaching makes a difference, but ultimately you can talk to lots and lots of coaches and the more talented team gives you a better chance than a team that's less talented. And so if you can work with your players and if that's what you're doing in the offseason and you're doing that skill development, you're working and you're getting them better. And yeah, maybe you're not working on your offensive sets. Maybe you're not working on your full court press together in a team setting. But if you're making your players individually better, then come back in the fall, your team's going to be infinitely better because they're more skilled. And then you can implement all the team stuff that I was just talking about.
Yep. I mean, in February when it's playoff time, you're not going to want a few more good plays. You're going to want a few more good players.
Right.
And that time's built. And I'm always respectful when I hear coaches talking about their aggressive springs and how they were working on closeouts and zigzag and all that, blockout drills, all this stuff in the spring. And I just think, okay, I'll hit that real hard before we start playing games. But I'm going to really focus on the hard part of the game, which is what they can do with the ball in their hands and how efficient and how great a shooter they can become, what their preparation is like mentally. Are they shooting unconsciously? I'm going to focus on those things in the spring, in the summer, and even in the fall, because I believe, and then also too, it goes to the, what type of style that you run and are you trying to have eight different continuities and eight different defenses and be good at all of them? Or are you trying to be great at just a few things? Yeah, I think through that simplicity comes a lot of confidence in your players, but then also maybe even in how you can put together your yearly plan, because I can just start to do more of what I would consider. And also, Mike, I'm also blessed to be at a school where basketball is probably third on the majority of these guys' lists. Hopefully it's the environment that faith brings. It's the academics that faith brings. And then basketball is the third thing. I have a couple guys where it's a little bit more like, mean for what it was for me and
right,
you,
but
not all of them. And so there's also this idea of it needs to be fun. And I just don't know. I mean, I know how I felt in the spring when it was a quote unquote defensive day. That just wasn't as much fun as when it was an offensive day or we were going to play pickup. And so just thinking of that idea too, like, I don't think there's anything wrong with fun and then getting creative with your skill work and bringing in some ideas that kind of open up their minds and maybe connect some dots a little bit.
When do you feel like as a head coach, you got a handle on your philosophy in terms of the off season, just in terms of the way that you wanted to play? How long did it take you into your head coaching career to feel like, and again, not that we always are adapting and evolving and growing. So there's always that, but where you felt like you were comfortable in your own skin with kind of, hey, this is the way that I'm going to do things. And it was no longer kind of like, okay, I got a piece of from this coach over here and this piece is over here. And it's kind of just all mixed up. When did it kind of coalesce into, hey, this is Matt's philosophy?
Yeah, you're right. Because I think especially early on, we're a combination of all of those voices that have poured into us.
Right.
And one thing I hate sometimes, I don't have it all figured out. And I know that. And there are dudes that are way better, smarter, have more wins. Like, I haven't won a state championship. Not that that's the only marker for success, but, there's just dudes that they just know so much more. But I do feel comfortable now. And I think in where we're at and the style of play and the plan, and Rick Torbett, I had him on and we were talking, and he said, you know, it takes you 10 years to figure out really who you are as a coach. And it kind of feels like that, because I started out as a varsity assistant at Neiman Forest. It's in Garland, and for a friend of mine and really good friend of mine, Jeff Clarkson. I was with him for a year, then went right to McKinney High School with a guy named Wes Watson. And, you know, Wes and I, we had a really good team my first year, and then we bottomed out. We went 8-21. And I'll tell you, man, we were scouting hard. We were a good, solid man-to-man team, knew everything the other team was going to do. And Coach Watson wanted to run this Bobby Knight style motion that when I was like 26 or 27, he would throw me in practice and I would say, Coach, this is good stuff, man. I can see it all. But our players couldn't see it. So it doesn't mean jack if I could see it and they can't see it. And so we ended up being 8-21, just hitting our heads against the wall. And we were coming back with a smaller team, but they had some skill. Dribble drive motion was just coming really out with, or becoming popular with Calipari at Memphis. And I got this packet, you know, a Vance Wahlberg packet. And I just said, you know, Coach Watson, will you let me take this? And I really think we could be great at it. And he wanted to press on the other side of it. So together, It was really a really cool thing for me as a young coach to see a older coach. He had already been there 15, almost 20 years. Allow me to take full control of the offense. And man, we went from averaging like 48 points a game to 68, hit a bunch of threes and went 25-10. It's whenever you go kind of running and gunning fast pace, it helps one when it works. And there was always those moments early on where we looked at each other like, do we need to change? Do we need to get out of this? And thankfully we just kept our you know, foot to the pedal and kept going. When you see it work and you see the joy and the fun, it's just hard to go back to anything else. And so I just took that running and gunning style. We kept playing with it for a few years. And then when I got to Faith, that was my first head coaching job. I've been there 9 years now, that I kind of had a feeling, especially offensively, of how I wanted us to play. But as far as the off-season stuff, that took me a few years. And it was really, I had a really good player. His name's Tyler Lumblady. He's at TCU right now. And Tyler was just a different kind of guy than we had at Faith before. 6'5", could handle it and shoot it. Big, strong kid. Dad played in college. And he was playing on a high-level select team where it was dominating a lot of his time. And so I just went to Tyler and I said, you know, Tyler, what would be the best for you this spring? Like, would it be to do these things, or do you feel like, you know, do we need to create a better plan? And we just kind of mapped it out a little bit together. And then I saw the other guys really enjoying it. Like, I don't know if you feel the same way, but guys just don't play unorganized pickup anymore, where it's like it's a laboratory where they get to try things out and make mistakes. Like, if I'm on the sideline and we're doing a controlled scrimmage, that's not pickup. Pickup is what you and I used to do. We go to the rec and we'd play against some random people and a couple dudes that can hoop. And, you know, if it kind of sucked that day, I'm going to play left-handed so I can work on that. You know, you just try things out. They don't get to do that anymore. And so all of this kind of put together created this plan about 3 or 4 years ago that it's just a ton of fun. And then, you know, we end up the spring we play some games that really have nothing to do or very little to do with basketball, some team building games. And I do a skills rating system that I put together about 15 years ago I don't know if it's the best way to do it. It's kind of like, I think it was Pat Riley said, it's It's not the only way to do it, but it's our way. And I think that's kind of where we've gotten right now in faith.
All right, explain that to me. I'm curious as to how you go about putting together that rating system.
Oh, the Jamoti skill rating. I'm excited to share this with you. I shared it with a coach for the first time ever. I can't remember who I was listening to. They said that as coaches, we need to hold on to nothing, meaning don't hide anything from anybody. Like, right. Let it all out there, share everything. Yeah. And I typically do that. I mean, obviously, I mean, we've been talking for about 45 minutes and it's easy to talk, but the skill rating is something, man, I haven't shared much. So because I got to have a good vibe with you, and I think you and I would enjoy just sitting and talking hoops for hours. So I'll share it with you today.
All right. Don't give away the whole secret. You can just give me, a piece.
I don't mind. It's out there.
Right.
It's out there.
So right, let's hear it.
I'm in my first year at Neiman Forest. I'm in the portable teaching ESL reading to some kids. And, you know, the great thing about the portable as a public school teacher is nobody comes checks on you there. Like you never get evaluated in the portable. And so, because 100 degrees,
you just close your door. You can do whatever you want.
And these kids are doing silent, sustained reading for 45 minutes a day. So I'm sitting around, and the Nike Spark number was out. And then I knew the NBA Combine. Like, they did a number, and I was like, you know, the Nike Spark number, that's really intriguing. You go to a combine, you get this number, you get to compare yourself to, kids from all over the place. And I said, and even the NBA Combine. is cool, but it's not basketball. It's just athleticism. And I mean, as a player, I knew, thankfully, that's just not our game. It's not completely our game, or else I would have never made a team. And so it's more than that. And I started to write down some drills. What are some things that I would like to incorporate? So the test became three categories: one ball handling, one shooting, and one athleticism. Within those categories, there were four drills that they had to do, so 12 total. And I wanted to do it to make it to where if I was a coach, I could take 30 to 35 guys through it in about a 40 to 45 minute range, and we could stay in the gym. You wouldn't have to go outside. You wouldn't have to have anything, you know, like even in NBA Combine, they bench. Well, that means you got to go somewhere, or they do a vertical test. You got to go somewhere, or you got to have fancy timing equipment. Like, I didn't want anything like that. And so with all the ball handling and shooting and stuff that I'd already been doing, and then just, you know, with four athletic pieces to it, I had a math teacher at the school put together an Excel sheet where you basically create a standard for every test. And the player's number you put against that standard, and it spits out a percentage point. And then you take those four percentage points and you get your shooting score. You take your three scores, athleticism, shooting, and your ball handling score, and it gives you the Jamoti skill rating. And you look at that number against all the other guys in your team. And I've told players over the years and parents, this isn't how I base our teams, but it doesn't hurt. It gives me a realistic look, because it's like a game day. You might be a great shooter, but you don't shoot well under pressure. Or maybe you had a great day and you just performed your tail off. And what it helps is those three categories. To me, it's like ball handling. And I just told our campers this today. It's ball handling helps with not just your dribbling. It helps with your passing. It helps you with your rebounding ability. I actually think better ball handlers are better shooters because they have control over the ball. They can literally tell it what to do, and it'll do it. And then the shooting piece is the hardest part of the test. So maybe their ball handling strong and they're an athletic kid. If their shooting is low, that gives me a really unique, when we have our end of year conversations, our 25, 50, 100% goal talks, it gives me a good view of where they're at as a player and what direction they need to go this summer and how I can help them, hold them accountable. And also, too, if a parent was to come in and wanted to talk about their son, I mean, I've got data. And here's the fun thing is if they come as a freshman, we do it four times a year. By the time they graduate, they've done it 12 to 16 times. So to me as a coach, it can validate, like I can mathematically show you that right. they've improved over the years. I can show myself that what I'm doing is working, you know, or golly, we just went a whole season and he didn't improve at all in any test, any category. I've got to adjust some things, or I bring that player in and we can have the talk that, you know what, is it what we're doing, or were you really bringing it? Did you really take advantage of your time? And I think those conversations, like a player knows, you know, coach, I didn't miss a day. I gave great effort. It's probably going to show the way that you want. And so that test to me, and over the years, I've fine tuned it and I've changed some things and I think it's at a place right now where I really love where it's at. And I tell the guys this too. And I'm sorry. I mean, you can cut me off at any moment if I'm rambling too long.
No, you're not. You're good.
I tell the guys too. It's like, you know, this test is meaningless if you don't care. If you don't care about your number, if you don't care about beating your previous score or beating your teammates. So like because there's a part of the test where it is objective, but then there's a part of it too. Like, what about the intangibles? If a kid who is in the 80s in the score, which that's a good level to be at. The 80s are typically your elite high school players that could play in college. 90s and above, they're definitely college players. But, you know, once they get to that level, they'll know early on by their scores if they can hit that number or not. Because it's just like if you're trying to go for 100, you can't miss many questions on the test. Or if you're not sure about a couple, you might have already messed up. And so in that point, I get to see how competitive are you? Can you continue to work hard in the face of defeat, sure defeat, which you're down 12 with 30 seconds left. You're probably not going to win, but can you continue to fight and work hard? I see that part of the test as well. And so at the end of the day, and then there's another part of it that I love is we get to, I'm always searching for ways to keep the names of our greatest players alive in our program. And so we have a record board out in our hallway and most of them are just statistical categories, most threes made, you know, most charges in a career, all of those things. But one category up there is Jamoti skill rating. And it's all of our best scores of all time. And so the guys know now, like to get on that board, you got to have an 86 or above, which means you're really having to have a good score to make that happen. So it's been a really fun thing over the years and it's the only thing I feel like I've ever actually done myself that I haven't borrowed from somebody else besides Nike Spark and NBA Combine.
It's cool because it's something that is unique to your program. It's something that regardless of, you could probably argue the exactly where it is and what the levels are. But the reality is after you've done it enough that now you have comparative data. So maybe the one-off data, you could argue and say, well, I'm not sure how relevant that is or not relevant it is. But you've done it now enough that you know, like you look at it and you say, hey, guys in the 80s is going to have a shot maybe at playing college basketball. Guys in the 90s, pretty sure that the track record, the history shows that those kids have a really good chance of being college basketball players. And it gives the kids in your program something to shoot for, something to aim for. And as you said, when you talk about competing and you talk about getting better, there's ways that you as a coach want your guys to compete against each other. But I think more importantly, you want guys competing against themselves when it comes to their skill development and their shooting. And I think there's no way, you and I both know, that you can improve something that you don't measure. And if you're not measuring it, then how do you know if you're getting better? And it's so important, I think, to, well, I was going to say write things down, although that may be a little antiquated, but
measure in a bunch of ways. Like I get to talk shooting with a lot of people, and And I talk about tracking. Like, if you're not actively tracking, to me, tracking with shooting really helps with role identification. If you want to play a style where it opens up and you have a lot of three-point attempts throughout the game from multiple people, it can't just be a free-for-all where they don't understand the pecking order, or they don't right. understand that I'm kind of open, but man, that green light is really open, and that should be a one more hero pass to that player. They need to know that. It can't wait for the moment that I tell them that it's passed, and or they've already made a mistake. And so when we're talking about tracking, like the Jamoni skill rating helps because I have this Excel sheet, but for some games, we write things down on a board in our gym, like literally write it down. So I think you're right on the money with that. But then also tracking can be, all right, guys, we just finished Ray Allen shooting. Raise your hand if you had one completed ladder or more. All right, keep your hand up if you had two or more. And so hands start to drop. That's tracking. That's measuring, because they get to look around and they get to constantly see every day whose hand is always up, whose scores are super high. And then if we want to have a culture of celebration in our team, when we hear a personal best, we snap, because I went to a director for PGC for 5 years. So snapping has become just a part of what I do. I can't stop it. And sometimes it annoys my wife, and it's okay. But like, we snap. Well, as soon as we hear a score that, man, I know you, that's a high score for you. That's awesome. Let's go. But that's tracking. And so I think you're right on the money. If we're not actively doing that, then how in the world can, besides, we've got to get past just the, I'm a coach, I can see your improvement. We've got to get past that. We've got to be able to show them through sometimes film, like, look what you just did. Like, that's incredible. You couldn't do that. But even that, we got to show them through data and letting them see through shooting games, through skill work, or any other metrics that you use.
Well, and nowadays, you think back to, I look at the eye test and I think this is what I see. And it's so easy now to watch film, and it's so easy to gather that empirical data than it used to be. And what we sometimes perceive as coaches, and you can think about this, I'm sure you watch a game and you think that one thing happened, or you remember it this way, and then you go back and you watch the film and it happened a completely different way. And then I think of it when you start talking about individual players. There's players that have played for me at various times that you look at them and you think, man, this kid's a really good shooter because they have beautiful form and everything looks good. But then when it actually comes time for a game, the ball just doesn't go in. But yet you still have this perception of this player as being a really good shooter because maybe their first impression they made on you was that they are a good shooter. Maybe their form looks really good. And I think in the past, a lot of times we would just stick with that idea of it's the eye test. And now, because we have access to so much data and because we track and do a lot of things that coaches at all levels are able to do, I just think it makes it so much easier to be able to have that conversation. As you said, I love the idea of a pecking order, right? When you're shooting, like, yeah, we're a team that gets up and down and we shoot a lot of threes. But look, man, guy X over here shoots 52% and you shoot 31%. So my 52% shooter over here needs to get more shots than you as the 31% shooter. And that's something that it's a lot easier to point to hard numbers, whether that's shooting from just shooting records from practice and from the spring and from the summer, or that's actual the game statistics. You can look at all that stuff. And if you have the data that you can show to a player, hey, this is why, or this is how it's going to go, or hey, if you want to get even more of a green light, you've got to get up to X percentage in practice before you're going to get that same level of green light that the guy next to you has. So there's so much that you can do with that, I think, at all levels. I think the challenge, and this is something that I'm curious about with you, I think one of the challenges that high school coaches sometimes face is they'd like to be able to track and have all that data, but a lot of times in practice, if you're trying to coach and you got your staff and they're trying to coach, and a lot of people don't have managers or people, it just, you know, you think about a Division I program, and sure, you got seven managers or eight guys, and then you have the practices filmed, and you got five, six, seven, eight coaches who can go break it down and chart percentages and all that. But as a high school, you may not have that. So how do you go about tracking the things that you do track from a logistical standpoint? How do you actually get those numbers down in the spreadsheet or on a piece of paper? What's the process for that?
Man, I love that. That's such a great question. I'm smiling the whole time as you're talking about that and asking it, because I thought about, I don't take really anything from game stats, meaning I don't judge on who should be shooting or not shooting based on that, because who's shooting in games better be the people that we've already discussed, or that, you know, now in my program, varsity especially, anyone who's open, and we discuss. So we have a shooting scale that, in my opinion, is one of the best things that we use to help with role identification. And any coach listening, if that needs to be day one of the fall, when you bring your guys into the school and you can work with them, it's not defense, it's not rebounding, it's a shot selection scale. Shot selection is the number one reason why people lose games. It's more important than any other, because if you've lost by 8 points, that's one bad shot or less. That's one bad shot a quarter and that's really in your control. You can block out great, but sometimes a bigger dude is just going to snatch it, you know, and sometimes a kid just dribbles off his foot. So turnovers matter, efforts matter, all those things matter, but shot selections, that's number one. And also too, just for the way that things flow and how guys train, there has to be a common language that we're talking about. So if we don't haven't already discussed those things and guys are shooting shots in games that they shouldn't, that I've already screwed up. It has nothing to do with what happened in that game. And so how do we create that, or how do we I think hopefully some coaches will appreciate this. It is hard at times to listen to guys that have five assistants, because there's some big high schools in Texas, and I'm not at one of them. I'm at a small school. All my other guys are part-time. And so I'm the only full-time guy at the school for boys basketball. And during second period, when we have an athletic period, it's me and 35 guys by myself. But it works. So what we do is, because shooting is what we do, and we want to let our guys know where they are, we want to have that good role identification, we do shooting games on top of some what I call braces for their shot or unbroken habits, some things that, you know, braces, I like that analogy because, one, it's high school, junior high kids, they're going through that time, and, you know, braces are slowly tightened. Your teeth are slowly straightened. It's not overnight. And so we're going to do things that just day by day by day get your shot to where you want it to be. But then also, I'm not a big fan of messing with form. I think it's 90% in between your ears, 10%. Unless you're Lonzo Ball, then that's bigger. But or old Lonzo Ball when he's like. But the rest right. of it, I mean, I don't care about those little things. I care more about your speed, your preparation, and then what you're thinking about. So with all of that, it's about shooting games. And bringing them in, tell them a game, they go out gym wide with their partner, bring them in, tell them we, and when I say record, it's, if we do Beal shooting, it's five spots, them and a partner to ball, make two at each spot or make two at a spot to conquer that spot, you get 2 points. If you conquer all five spots, you have 10 and you shoot bonus shots for all worth one. I mean, just an example, that's a game we like to play, but all I have to do is come in and say, raise your hand if you had 10 or more. And most of the hands will shoot up. And there's times where if we have, we'll have our records written down on the board for just those games. I don't track individually everything they do, but it's them acknowledging it. They have to own their scores and their teammates hearing that and seeing that. And then there's some games where we do write every score down and they are held to a higher standard. And I do pull a lot, like a green, yellow, red. I do pull a lot from that. But that's every day for 187 days, give or take, that we're, because in our athletic period, it's all skill development. So by the time it's school or after school team practice, well, shot selection and role identification is taken care of. And so now it's more of just helping them through that shot selection scale, asking them, will you rate that shot? What do you think that was? Well, it was a six. Well, yeah, I agree with you. Let's be a little bit more patient for a seven. It's those kind of conversations instead of, we just finished a game. Man, that guy shot like crap. Let's bring him in and show him all of the misses that he had. And if that's happening, if a guy that shouldn't be shooting a ton is, that's on me. Or if a guy that should be shooting a ton, if he misses, the only thing I tell him is, you're about to get hot. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think that it speaks well to the fact that you have to be prepared in practice to do what it is that you're going to do in games. And the things that happen in games shouldn't be a surprise to you as a coach and shouldn't be a surprise to your players. It's not like all of a sudden a guy who isn't a good shooter suddenly is jacking up 10 or 12 or whatever.
No, you shouldn't be surprised. Outside the line.
Right.
Shouldn't
exactly.
Be surprised.
Because you've done the prep work and you've helped the kids to understand what their role is and how they go about fulfilling that role.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the portfolio guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
How do you help players to define their roles on your team? What does that look like for you?
I really do think like green, yellow, red is a game we do. It's three guys, two basketballs, nine spots, shoot 10 shots at a spot. And you've got to get those 90 shots in those 4 minutes. We do that at least 10 times before our season so that we can get a really good average. And we celebrate 45 and or above as a green light. And you start to get those 45s or above when some guys are in the 60s or above. I mean, again, it's role identification every single day. And it's the building of confidence in some of the guys when they're starting to see those numbers grow. And you know, when guys start to trust them a little bit more, but it's going to be more one-on-one conversations. I can't remember the time I've ever told a guy, we don't use that language, like that's a bad shot or don't shoot that shot. Again, they should be shooting the shots that they know that come out of our offense or out of our flow. But those are conversations where it's more of the selection and that scale of is that the best that we could have had that possession? And I help them come to it and really find out what they see, because one of my buddies says players have to do what they see. And so if they see that they were open for a seven, which is an uncontested jump shot within their range, that within their range part comes from, I don't want them to choose what that is. They need to know what that is. That comes from our training and our shooting games that we do. But those conversations are quick and easy. And the shooting scale also takes the emotion out of it. Because if you want players playing free and with courage, shooting 30 to 40 threes a game, you can't worry about shooting percentage, and you can't worry about, you don't want them worrying about makes and misses. You know, what does a miss mean? It means the next one's probably going in. And those types of conversations and phrases, man, when that's just swirling around the gym, you asked a little bit, how do we train? We have six baskets. We only have one gym at the high school. We have one at our junior high. six baskets, me, and then with partners. And we just get as many of those games in as we can in a 37 to 42 minute time. You'd be surprised if you train like a wild animal, not a zoo animal, how much you can really get done in that time.
I love that analogy, and I've heard that one before. And when you think about how the game of basketball is played, right? It's a dynamic game. It's not a game where you as the coach can say, okay, we're going to go out there and player X is going to go to the right four steps and player Y and this wide receiver is going to run this play.
You can't joystick
this pattern.
Yeah.
Right. You can't joystick them at all. And unfortunately, in a lot of cases, and I think we're doing a better job in the coaching profession of getting away from some of that block practice and putting our kids in more dynamic situations. And you hear a lot about small-sided games now, the number of coaches that are teaching out of that, and the games-based approach, and just the way that we've evolved as coaches to put kids in better positions to be able to make our practices more like the games. And that's what I hear you saying, is that, look, my guys, by the time we get to a game, they've already been in these situations. They understand what it is that's expected of them. And that's not to say that you can be prepared for every eventuality, but what you're trying to do in practice is give them as many reps and let them see as many situations and things that they're actually going to see when they get out on the floor on Friday night and they're playing in front of a crowd. You want them to be familiar with those decisions and not have something come up like, oh, now suddenly I don't know what a good shot is because I've never been put in this situation. No, we've been in this situation over and over and over again, and that's what helps us to train and to be able to have a better understanding of how we actually attack the game when it comes to live action. Because basketball, like I said, is such a dynamic sport that you have to learn the game by playing the game. And there's obviously a fundamental base that you need to have, but you also have to just be able to read and understand situations and have a feel for the game. And that's something that you can't teach that through a static drill. You have to teach that through the game and through patterns and drills and things that look like the game, as opposed to, hey man, go up against this cone and just work on this skill in isolation.
But then, yeah, and to your point too, that's why skill work sometimes in season, and I felt it as a player and maybe early on as an assistant coach, and if I'm not careful, I'll fall to it as well, of allowing individual skill work to fade away. Because it's team time, team concept. We have to prepare for this next opponent. And thankfully, and maybe just because I'm not smart enough, we play such a simple style that on both sides of the floor, we just don't really, not arrogance, we don't have to prepare for them. That's not it at all. We get beat plenty. But we're going to do only a few things. And that skill work, needs to be, or for us, it's the most important part of our practice. Like thankfully, our offense creates mainly paint finishes or kick catch threes or catch threes. So because of that, it can really give me tunnel vision on what type of skill work we need. Like my guys just need to shoot a ton of catch threes. And they need to shoot them fast, and they need to shoot them from distance. Because of that, like, we get to have those good conversations with guys. Like, guys, why do most players miss in games? Because I don't think that's discussed a lot. You know, we talk about low shooting percentages, or we acknowledge that guys miss in games, but we don't really talk about why. In my opinion, the reason is because they train too slow and they train without pressure. Those two things. So I could tell them, guys, listen, you know, when you're practicing on your own, you need to train fast and you need to train with pressure. Like, okay, that's just not going to happen. I mean, I didn't even do that. Like, training by myself, I got to a level, but not to gain that type of pressure. And so we have to create that environment in practice, in skill development times, of our games, because of a time component, in a rows, something that you're trying to beat, there's a consequence for losing, you know, because of all that, I feel the shots that they're taking in practice are actually, like you said a second ago, it's actually what they're doing in games. Because of that, that's where our confidence comes from. That's where confidence comes from, is actually preparing. You can't look in the mirror and lie to yourself and say that I'm prepared for these shots in games when I don't really know what they feel like or I've never done them. But I think early on, I was one of those coaches that said, man, if we only had better shooters, we could do this and that. Well, at some point, I think it's like hope isn't a plan. I think it's tough. It's tough to keep saying that. And unless they move in, which they've never really moved in, we got to start creating some shooters, which means I'm not going to say, hey, great practice, guys. Go home, do your schoolwork. Oh, yeah. And before you go to bed, shoot 100 threes. That's not going to happen. I'm going to sacrifice defense time, rebounding time, or whatever time for shooting. And because ultimately, that's what we want our guys to do really well. We want to give ourselves always a puncher's chance because we shoot the ball so much. And also, too, at the school that I'm at, with the kids I have, what's the most fun thing to do, fellas? Oh, coach, it's shooting. You know what? Let's start practice that way. Like, let's start practice shooting 100 threes instead of, well, what about defensive slides first? You know what? That's important, no doubt. But let's shoot 100 threes before we get there. It's just that type of thinking has helped us to do some of the things with shooting that we've done.
It's a great point, and it's one that I can remember at times when I was a varsity assistant coach and be going through drills and be doing a shooting drill, and you'd see a kid kind of moping their way through that drill, and you might pull them aside and say to the kid, hey, man, if you're not going to work hard at a shooting drill, what are you going to do when we get to a defensive drill? Like this – I mean, this is the reason why anybody picks up a basketball, right? We don't pick up a basketball so that we can work on our passing or so we can get in our defensive stance. You pick up a basketball so you can shoot it and put it through the basket and hear that sound. And so I feel like that if anything, as a coach, when you think about how important the skill level is in terms of shooting, and I look at it, I've had a bunch of conversations with my co-host Jason and I, when we talk and do our weekly NBA show, we've been talking a lot here during the playoffs about just how a lot of these games have come down to whether or not role players make threes or not. And so many of these games have just come down to, it's not like, you know, the stars are going to come through and play well. And yeah, there might be a little variance, but it's like if your secondary players are going to shoot 45% from three, You're either gonna win that game, or if you're not winning it, it's because the other team's role players did the exact same thing. And if you're gonna shoot 25% from three, you're probably gonna lose that game. And it just shooting in today's game is at such a premium. And I think that ultimately you can watch youth basketball games and you can see teams that do beautiful things and then the ball just doesn't go in. Yeah. And when the ball doesn't go in, you don't get 2 points. And so shooting is a great equalizer. It really is.
Like, what's the ultimate goal? We got to score one more point than them, fellas. Like one more point. Yeah. Now, right. And I mean, some guys would love to see those scores be in the 40s or 30s. I typically like for them to be in the 70s, 80s, or 90s. It's just more enjoyable. If I have to sit there on the bench because I can't play anymore, if I have to sit there on the bench and I'm not allowed to shoot it myself, I want to at least watch something that is enjoyable. I told my assistant coach a couple of years ago, like we put in this zone that has really helped our program, and it's aggressive zone. So the people that are anti-zone, like I used to be, I get it. But it's a really nice 3-2 zone that's given our guys, it's made our guys appear more athletic, which I think that's something where if you take a lot of decision making away or the amount of decisions that they would have to make defensively, like a man to man, he's got to guard so much and it can really slow guys down. And so in this zone, it makes us more athletic. But we were just guarding so well. The possession was like 45. We don't have a shot clock. It was like 45 seconds long. And I looked at him. I said, golly, we're just playing too good a defense right now. Like we're stopping them from doing things. We can't get the ball back. And so there's a way that the game, it should be played. But to your point, that was just a tangent. But when to your point of the shooting, you're right on the money with everybody has at least one or two dudes that perform relatively well, each night. But I don't look at shooting percentage. I couldn't tell you what our 3-point percentage was. I know that we led the nation in attempts, which I'm very thankful for that, but I don't know about the percentage. I look and I see, okay, my main guys, they made three or four threes, but man, we're at 16 makes. Like, where'd all this comes from? It's he had one, he had two, he had one, he had a crazy three out of nowhere, but in those adding up. And then to me, if you want to invest in shooting and you want your players to do that, then you have to have a style of play that they believe it'll actually happen. I mean, I ran flex in college and that was brutal at times. When you're running flex against Kansas and they're pressuring you up at half court, because you're trying to make this stupid reversal pass, 30 feet from the goal, and Heinrich is in your jock. You're like, this is what the only thing I can do right now is this pass.
Matt, is no players from Kansas had ever seen the flex before, so they had no idea what was coming. Right?
They had no clue. So, right. So yeah.
I used to say it about at Kent. We would our coach Jim McDonald. He had previously been an assistant at Toledo, and they had run. So he was, by the time I got to Kent, he was in, I don't know, it was maybe his eighth, ninth year at Kent. And then he had been an assistant at Toledo for another 5, 6, 7, 8 years, something like that. And so basically this offense that we ran had been being run in our league for 15 years. And so we'd call out our play and you'd make the cut and the guys on the other team would be like, hey, all right. I'll meet you down here. I know exactly where you're going to go. And to your point, like you're trying to make those passes. You're just like, oh my gosh, like can we get a little bit of creativity here in what we're doing? And just, man, today's game is the way it's opened up is just, it's incredible compared to the system that I played in. It sounds like the same system that you played in, it's just crazy. Yeah.
Let's just say that you have 18 quick hitters. That's what you run is 18 quick hitters. Those are most likely for the same guy or two. Why in the world would 3 through 8 or 10 stay after practice and work on their shot? You could say, well, to become one of those guys, that's hard. It's hard to overcome the guy that's already in that spot who is getting more of the reps, more of the experience, more of the time, has more confidence instilled from their coach. Like it's hard for players 3 through 10 to do that. If you have a guy that he's just a screener, all I do is I sit there and the ball never comes. Why would that guy work on shooting? So again, I think it does go to there has to be this almost like a marriage between the skill work that you want the guys to do, but what they're actually going to be allowed to do when they play. And so because of a free-flowing offense where if you are open, you truly allowed to shoot that three, but the beauty of the pecking order and them understanding, each other and where they're at in that lineup, it just sees the ball move. And we celebrate ball move. We celebrate one more. They still get acknowledged for making those hero passes. It's like I could shoot it great, but even if I won more, it's just as good. Like that's a special place to be. And it is hard. I mean, next year's team at Faith, we have a lot of returners. Like we've got two or three guys that have the ability to make over 100 threes next year each. Man, will they be unselfish enough? Like will that me monster, will they be able to push that down? That's why humility is such a huge piece or should be part of any culture is like, just remember guys, it's not about you. But even though our system sometimes seems like it's all about you because it's about your skill work, your shot. Man, it's all for you to take what you can do. And just like any good family or any a member of society, take what you do really well and let's fit it into this thing now. But it just happens to be more fun when they all really think they can, they're allowed to shoot it.
That's a great point. I think it's really difficult sometimes to be a kid who is quote unquote a role player where, hey, I'm doing this and this is all I get to do. And the coach yells at me as soon as I dribble or if I even think about taking a shot that's anything other than a layup. And even a layup, I might get a sideways glance from the coach. But that can't be any fun for a kid to be in that environment. And to your point about just the game and the way that we play it today, everybody, regardless of your size, players are more skilled now than they've ever been. And as a result of that, you just get kids that are playing all over the floor. It's a fun system. It enables you to continue to motivate guys all up and down your roster. So guy 11, guy 12, who maybe 20 years ago, 25 years ago, all that kid's getting to do is maybe subs in on the scout team and sets some screens and goes in and tries to rebound and foul the star player. Now that kid's getting opportunities to get shots up and be able to do some of the fun things that are part of the game because of the system that you're playing. And it's the fact that it's free-flowing, just allows everybody to get involved. And to me, that makes a lot of sense because the game, as you said, it's supposed to be fun. And yeah, what you're doing is going to help you win games as well if you execute it correctly. But ultimately, it's a lot more fun to play the style of basketball that you're describing than it is to play Norman Dale Hoosier basketball.
I love that movie. Can't stand that quote. Five passes until you score? Heck no. If it's a seven off of, or a wide open jump shot within the range off of no passes, that's just as good as a seven after five passes. So, there's some other phrases we could get into too that I don't appreciate. Like, oh, we've just shot three threes in a row. Do something different. No, if they're the right shot that possession, we have to disconnect possession from possession from possession. We ask our players to do that. Like, hey, you just made a mistake. Let that go. Defend now. You know, lock in here. Don't think about the past. But then as coaches, offensively or whatever, we just shot we just shot five threes in a row and they haven't gone in. We need to do something different. Why? If they're the right, now, if you're taking bad shots, of course, coach, have those discussions. Like, guys, we're taking sixes right now. Those contested jump shots are going to get us beat. We need to make the ball work. We need to hunt the world. We need to drive. We need to kick. And we need, once that happens, we get our flow going. You'll see the ball go through, no doubt. But if those are great shots, then the only thing we do is clap and we say next, next, again, again. But that's where you get to see incredible runs. And to your point about the role players having a little bit more buy-in, or I think if you train your role players like they're your star players, they'll surprise you. Because I've just seen it happen where maybe my quote-unquote star players are a little bit off. And man, that role player that typically doesn't shoot as many, he's the spark. He's the one that gets us going. And I can think about it was senior night this year in district, and I put a kid in that. I mean, I gave him the Lion Award, which that Lion Award is dear to my heart. It's like Mr. Hustle. That was the only award I ever got in college for my team. And at the time, I thought, that's the only award that you get. That's the award you give to the guy that you can't think of anything else to give him. But that's what I thought at the time. But now I look back and it's like, I'm very proud of that. Like, I did hustle. I did create that type of role for myself. But this kid was a great leader. I mean, just what a faith student is all about. But I just couldn't find him a lot of time. Senior night, I always start the seniors. And he comes out, I kid you not, 18 points in the first quarter. He had four threes. It was like, our gym's not huge. It was incredible. But even it was a special moment. Like, I got choked up a couple times standing there watching him and his parents and grandparents just love that moment. But at the same time, too, he trains that way every day. You know, it's not like he doesn't shoot or he doesn't practice. Like, where did that come, Hooper? Where'd that come from? No, I've seen him shoot every day. There just happens to be other guys that are farther ahead. But I like that, your idea of, you know, we got to make sure those role players are training for, because I think we give that lip service sometimes as coaches of, you never know. You got to be ready for your moment. Your moment will come. Well, will it really?
Right.
Like, are, exactly. They, are
as,
we really
as
gonna,
a former as a former player, you know that it rarely comes.
Yeah. Coach Bliss would come down. Oh man, I can remember him coming down to practice. And I mean, over my 4 years at Baylor, I played every game, but I didn't play every game the same amount. And he would come down and he'd see me and he'd say, Matt, you know, Matt, tell me what you think about this. And the moment he said that, I thought, oh crap, he's going to put me on scout team today. And he would do it. He'd say, tell me what you think about this. And he'd talk about this shift or this new thing in flex that he wanted to try to do because we weren't smart enough to run anything else. And, right. And I said, yeah, coach, that makes sense. That makes sense. He's like, all right, well, since you got it, I want you to be on the white team, which was our scout team today, you know, white jerseys, not right, anything right. else. And, yeah. and, you know, but yeah, I want you to be on that team today. And I just like, it would hurt every single time because I knew he wasn't looking at me. He was only looking at the green team, the guys in those jerseys. I was going to get coached by the assistant coach that didn't even know our plays because he was scouting most of the time. Like, we'd roll into practice, be like, what do you run? Yeah, just do that. Right? Like, so I don't want to be that yep. guy where I'm just telling guys, work hard because you never know when your time is, but I really know they probably won't have one. I mean, injuries happen. Sickness, especially now more than ever, happens to where you just never know when this football guy that you really weren't expecting much out of has 22 points in a district game hitting three threes that if you would have told me at the beginning of the season, I said, you're nuts. I think it's fun to have those type of surprises throughout the year.
It really is. And it gives those kids an incentive. It gives them a motivation and it makes them feel like they're more a part of it when they're getting to do similar things to the things that the starters, that the star players are getting to do. And let's face it, if you don't have buy-in from the back end of your roster, I don't care if it's a high school team, I don't care if it's a college team, I don't care if it's a pro team, if the guys at the back end of your roster are unhappy and they start sniping and they start complaining and they start doing and saying things, we've all been around environments where that can go south really, really fast. And if you can find ways as a coach to keep those kids engaged and to keep them working and to keep them competitive, man, you've done such a great service to those kids, but also you've done a great service for your team and the success that you're going to have because you're going to have better practices. You're going to have better attitudes. You're going to spend less time as a coach dealing with problems. And to me, those are the kinds of solutions that I think everyone as a coach is searching for all the time.
That's good.
All right, let's talk. We're about to blow by an hour and a half here. So I want to make sure
And I want to let you know, like, I'm good with that because this has been tons of fun. So I'm all for keeping going if you are. But at any point, if you're like, hey, this is enough. I've heard from this guy from a small school in Texas enough. You cut it, okay?
Well, I think what we're gonna have to do is I think we're gonna have to have a part two because we're I definitely want to talk player stuff and talk about your time at Baylor and talk about your book and dive into that. But let's sort of meander towards the end here by talking podcasting. Tell me a little bit about the idea behind your podcast, when you got it started, why you got it started, what your process looked like, and then we can kind of trade notes and compare ideas.
Okay. Yeah, it really started two reasons. At PGC, I got to direct for them. And a lot of the things we've even talked tonight, like learning from those, they're just geniuses. Dick DiVenzio, the founder of PGC, I got to I was an athlete at two of his sessions. You know, he died in 2001, but he was just an incredible teacher of the game. And PGC has always had such a big influence on me. And then getting to direct for them for 5 years, that helped a ton too. But at the end of those sessions, as a director, at the end of each night, I would bring the observing coaches together, and we were supposed to have like a 5 to 10 minute debrief on, just what they saw today, what they liked, how are they going to implement some things back home. But it ended up like they would go 2 or 3 hours. And I just found myself just loving this time with these coaches and I do think, I mean, it's a unique style of play. I mean, that we run, and I'm not running out there with McDonald's All-Americans. And, so they wanted to talk about those things because it's hard not to mention that when I was, maybe teaching throughout the day or something. So it was just so much fun to talk about hoops and shooting and coaching and culture and all those things. So I love that. And then pandemic hit. And I was, sitting around the house like everybody else, and a lady wanted to talk about shooting from a high school in DFW. And I had never met her before. We got on a Zoom and we're talking, and then somehow it just shifted to culture. And she talked about this activity that she had where she would take her kids off to a cabin before the season. I thought, well, that's not unique. Like, a lot of people do that. But then she talked about this talk that she would have with her players and the way it would lead them to get to know each other and to build this foundation. And I said, will you share that with me? Like, that's just so good. And I thought, this is a girls coach at a high school that, I'm not really near that. There would probably never be a chance for me and her to interact outside of this, but this was so impactful. And I thought, how many other, like, most of the time on these podcasts, that's why I'm honored that you'd have me on, they're famous people. I mean, they're guys that you watch them or you hear from them a ton, but there's just so many great high school coaches out there that right down the road from us are doing incredible things that, I tell guys, TABC is a big organization in Texas, Texas Association of Basketball Coaches, and they have high school coaches speak at the clinic every year, but you only get asked to speak if you win state. And so, like, that's a small number of guys. Like, the odds are I'll never get asked to speak there. I hope I do, but, if we shoot it well enough, I will, but. I didn't say defend well enough, because that's not it. But if we shoot well enough, we'll get there. But that was kind of where it came from. I've always enjoyed talking with coaches, and then Zoom became such a common thing. And in the DFW area, there just wasn't a lot of people, or wasn't really anybody, trying to highlight high school coaches. It's been fun to talk with some college guys and learn from them. But I just feel like I've had these one-on-one clinics with guys, and I get to ask them the questions that I really want to know. Like, what would you do if you could start over? What would you do differently? What are the standards in your program? How do you teach or help players with confidence? Like, those are the things that just whenever I hear somebody talking about, I lean in and then getting to, it's kind of on, I'm an honor to get to be on here with you because, I'm at 53 episodes right now. You're at 600 plus. And I listened to your episode with Matt McLeod, and it was just like, you're a master at, in my opinion, you're a master at doing this, the way you ask questions, the way it flows. And even ours tonight, besides me rambling on too much, like, it's just been phenomenal the way that you bring it around and do things. So, all that to say, yeah, it's been a blast. The Jamoti podcast, I've had so much fun with it so far.
That's awesome. And I think you highlighted something that has been one thing that we've really enjoyed, which is getting an opportunity to talk to coaches at all levels. And we've had the opportunity to have some bigger name people on that everybody's heard of, but we've had just as many people on that nobody has heard of, except maybe people in their local area or their county or their state. And what you find is that there are great, great, great coaches, great basketball minds all over the country, all over the world, and at all different levels doing all different kinds of things. And I think that's what's been the most interesting for us, is just getting an opportunity to talk to those people, to be able to pick their brains, to be able to give them a platform to share their knowledge, which, to your point, as you said, who are the guys that go and speak at clinics? They're coaches that win state tournaments. They're coaches that have big-time Division I athletes. And look, there are great coaches that have those things, but there are also great coaches that do not have those things. And what we found is that no matter whether it's a high school coach from Texas, or it's a high-level Division I coach, or it's an NBA assistant, or it's somebody that's on TV, everybody brings something to the table because ultimately they love the game of basketball. And everybody kind of attacks that love in a different way, whether they do a podcast, whether they're a coach, whether they're an announcer, whether they coach at the high school level, they're an assistant, they're a head coach. Everybody brings that love for the game that we started out this podcast talking about. Where did your love for the game of basketball come from? And for everybody, it ends up kind of manifesting itself in different ways. And I've said this on the podcast, that one of the things that is interesting to me in talking to all these coaches that I never realized when I was a player, and I don't know if you realized this when you were a player, but the number of guys that were managers at the college level that went to be a manager because they felt like that was a route for them to go into coaching. And when I was a player, I always thought, man, these guys are managers. They must really like us players. And they just want to hang around the team and think that we're really cool and they want to be a part of it. It never once crossed my mind that somebody was going to be a manager because they wanted to be a coach. Never crossed my mind.
Yeah, that's the door. That's the door they could get it, you know, go through. Yeah.
I did not see that at all back when I was playing. And you just learn a ton from everybody that you talk to. And that's what's been really fun about it. And then the second piece that I always have this conversation, usually when the podcast ends, but it's worth having it now, that it's not very often that you get a chance to talk to somebody in your life for an hour and a half. Who's the last person that you had an hour and a half conversation with? Maybe your wife back when you were dating early on in your relationship, right? You might sit on the phone and talk for an hour and a half.
That's right.
But it's certainly
now it's 30 seconds. 30 right. seconds is the longest right. phone call with it. Yeah.
Where are we going now? Or where do we have to get the kids to? Or when's the next game? And all those things. Yeah. And so you just don't get the opportunity. So we've been able to build such great relationships. And again, not with every single person that's been on the podcast, but with a lot of people that have been guests, we've developed honest to goodness, genuine friendships, and people that I've been different places and I've hooked up with people and met with them in person. And those are the kinds of things that I never, ever would have guessed would have happened as a result of this silly podcast. And there's no way to replace that. And just the love for basketball and how much people appreciate what the game has done for them. And then consequently how much they want to give back by telling their story. And we just feel like we've been able to, for whatever reason, we've been able to build this little platform to give people an opportunity to do that. And in some way, I feel like we're giving back directly to our guests, and then hopefully we're also giving back to our audience. So that's kind of where we didn't start out with those intentions. It wasn't the way we planned it out, but it's kind of the way it's gone. And to hear you talk about giving a platform to high school coaches, I couldn't agree more, just because, again, there's so much knowledge at every level of the game.
It's been phenomenal. I've been blown away by how in every talk, there is oftentimes more than one thing, but there's at least one thing that I thought, man, like, I needed to hear that.
Yeah.
Like, I'm literally having this conversation for that reason. And coaches at all different levels. And then I even like to get outside of that a little bit with some strength coaches. I noticed you've had some guys that aren't necessarily, coaching a team at a certain level right now. But they all just have such interesting perspectives. And what I love about the community, and you just alluded to it too, is just how willing guys are to share. And it's really fun for me to get to hear their passion come through, you know, what they're talking about. And then great reminders for myself as somebody that at times can feel like I don't understand why not everybody doesn't play the way we play. Like that thought goes through my mind sometimes. It's a great reminder that, man, there are a ton of ways to do this. And guys have had a lot of success in doing it the way that they are. And sometimes they will say some things that make me really have to do a deep dive into something that I believe with our team, with our program, or with coaching or leading. And then other times it validates what we're doing as well. And so it has been such a satisfying thing. And I've been blown away. I mean, to me, it's like, I don't know what the difference is. Like, if I think I'm an eighth grade player right now talking to an NBA player. Like, that's the difference between our levels with what we're doing here.
You give me a little too much credit, Matt.
I think that's close. Okay, you're a European pro,
and I'm a. I'll take that one.
But that's pretty darn good though too. So it's like, I've just been blown away with your level of organization. You know, the way even so with social media, what you guys do. I was scrolling through it today. I was like, golly, they post every hour.
We try to get stuff out. Yep.
Yeah. And what I like too is that it's, so I put episodes out on a Monday. And then I try to do a few things throughout the week with it. But then once that episode's over, it's kind of done. But I'm kind of looking through, like, you're referencing guys over and over and over again. And that just, it was like a light bulb moment for me today. You know, I need to be reminding, I mean, again, there's not a lot of followers there, and that's okay. But I need to be reminding people of the episodes and things that have gone through. So I've learned a ton from you already.
Well, I appreciate that. And I don't know that any of the stuff that we're doing, it's like, I've had conversations with people. Hey, what are we doing social media wise? Is it good? Is it bad? Does it work? Does it not work? And we try to go through, and as you said, we try to recycle old episodes. And what I found, and it's kind of the formula we've tried to stick with, and you can kind of sense it with your episode too, is that I try to create interviews that are somewhat evergreen, that we're not talking about, hey, well, how was your season last year? And what about your performance in the state tournament? It's more just tell me about your program. Let's build your culture. Let's tell your story, so that somebody could listen to this episode 3 years from now and it could still be very, very relevant. And so that's what we've tried to do on the social media side, is to be able to go back and just kind of recycle those episodes. And like I said, I have no idea whether or not our social media strategy is a good one or not a good one. We just kind of keep throwing stuff at the wall and see what we think will work and what will be helpful. And I don't claim at all to be an expert. And it's part of what honestly has been fun about this whole process, is learning the social media side of it, or at least to whatever degree we've learned it, and learning the technology and figuring out how to get it to work and what the sound quality could be compared to what it sounded like at the beginning. And you mentioned, and I appreciate the kind words about being an interviewer. When you go back and listen to those first few episodes and I hear myself talking, I'm like, oh, that is just, it just sounds awful. And you become very conscious of the number of times you're saying, and all those things. And you have to be, it's just like a coach. Like, you go back and listen and you think, man, I'm doing way too much of that, not enough of this. And so then you try to adjust and grow, and it's a process. And I think what you want to do is you want people to appreciate what you do as a host, and yet you don't want to get in the way of what the guest is trying to share, because ultimately you're the one tonight that's bringing the knowledge. You're bringing new things to the table. I've been on this for 640 episodes. The people have heard a lot of my stories that I've told at various times to different people on the pod. And so they want to hear from you. And it's a little bit of an art and a dance to you want to share some things because you want this to be a conversation. And yet at the same time, people didn't tune in to hear my story. They turned in to hear from you. And I think that's what ultimately makes it interesting.
That's a good point, because I had Brian McCormick on. I haven't put that episode out yet, but he's fascinating to me.
He's great. The, love Brian.
Fake Fundamentals. And I read that. And so I was really trying to I contacted him, and it took a little while to make it happen, because he's over in Estonia right now. But he it was before our talk, he had tweeted out something about how he hated listening to podcasts where the hosts wouldn't let the guy they're interviewing or whatever, they wouldn't let him talk. And wouldn't listen to him. And I thought, okay, remember that, you know, like when I'm talking to him, but just to be present.
Right.
When that person, cause what, you know, and you had kind of mentioned a little bit, I along the same lines, it's, you probably dive a little bit more into the past of the person, a little bit more than I do, because there's parts of, I love going to clinics. But at clinics, when I'm live with a person, I'm sitting in an audience, I just have to sit and whatever they choose to address. If it's a 2-3 zone, that's it. That's all I get from that person. And so with this, I put a list of questions together. I think I'm up to 23 questions now that, like, here are the things that I would love to know about almost any coach out there. And it definitely will guide a little bit the direction of it, but then within it, it's always fun to, you know, to let it flow and find new rabbit holes. But I do a little bit of an intro before, because, you know, full transparency, sometimes when the first 20 minutes of an interview or 30 that or a podcast I'm listening to, if it's just the backstory, but I know that some things are coming, like, I just go to that. And so I thought, what about a podcast that's pretty much just all that, where they get to hear about the guy real quick, but then, all right, what standards are what's your program built on? And you know, like where you said, I love that with three years later, they go back. It's not about their miracle season that they had. It's about things that, man, maybe that's an area of my planning that I just don't have down, or something I needed to hear about. So I'm right on board with what you're saying.
It's really interesting to, because we've played around with the format and thought about it and tried to figure out, hey, like, our episode's too long. That's a conversation that Jason and I have all the time. So speaking of, you know, we're at an hour and a half. And so it's like, we go back and forth, and we're like, well, do more people listen to episodes that are only an hour? Do more people listen to episodes that are an hour and a half? Does it matter? Does it not matter? And we've kind of just come to the conclusion that we like going for as long as we like to go. And with some people, it's less. With some people, it's more. Depending upon the schedule on a given day, we might have to go less than we want because somebody else is coming on after that. And so it's just, there's a lot of things that go into it, but to your point, I think everybody you find value in different things. And depending upon what you're trying to get out of the podcast, you can find those nuggets, and you can find what it is that you're looking for. And there's so many podcasts out there, right? Just like there's so many camps out there. There's so many leagues and AAU teams and all this stuff that you kind of just hope that your audience that finds you, you kind of almost have to please yourself and hope that you find that audience, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to – you took it right out of my mouth. I said my motivation at the end of the day is to learn to be better for my players at Faith. If I can do that every talk that I have, then it's a success, because, I mean, obviously, if it was about listeners or followers – well, I'm a colossal failure at this point. So it can't just be about that. And so I completely agree with the motivation there. And then, you know, you had mentioned a little bit I kind of took a Joe Rogan approach, I think, to it, of he does long episodes. So some of mine are an hour and a half. I think my longest is like an hour 45 or so. But that really depends on, one, the person, like, I've found that some of the maybe bigger name people, they don't have as much time. Or if I don't have a relationship with them, there's not as much back and forth. Or and some guys don't. Like, I don't know if in our talk tonight, I'm pretty sure I didn't do a very good job of asking you many questions or your opinion. And maybe that's because I rarely get asked questions. And so I just ran with some answers and kind of took it. But, you know, a lot of guys, I like to ask questions and I like to listen to their answers, but sometimes there's not that give and take where it can go for a long time. But what Joe Rogan does is he does his long episode, puts that out, but then he also does what he almost has like a separate channel for his clips. And so on Mondays, I put out the long one, but then on Tuesday through Friday, it's the it's different based on the questions they choose. The questions they choose, it's the little clips. And, you know, it's one of those things where, unfortunately, I don't know what I don't know. I don't know if people like the long one. I don't know. I've had a couple coaches say that, you know, like they really appreciate the you know, 15-minute clip that's all around the one question. And I try to choose, like if a guy chooses four or five questions, I try to choose the three or four that really I think that there was that was strong. And then or sometimes it just goes a completely different direction and we kind of form a new clip from that. But that's been fun. And, but I am just trying to figure it out and also make it a way where it's manageable. Cause it's just me. Like I'm a one man show. So I during the season, I don't want this to be stressful. And so I think I figured out a way to where it's basically one day's worth of work a week. Or a few hours that day, and then I can make it happen.
It's almost like exercise, right? You got to find something that you love to do or else you're not going to do it. And that's how podcasting is. Like I'm the same way where Jason, previously when we first started, he has two older sons. One's 8 and one's 6. And then 2 years ago, he went and had another daughter. And then 7 weeks ago, he went and had another one. So we were just getting to the point where we were kind of getting a rhythm and we were kind of sharing some duties in the back end. And then that kind of went away. And so I've heard the
without my guest thing a couple times on your deal. Right. I was like, man, where is this guy?
He's with his 7 week old, a 7 week old. He's on baby duty. So he texted
me. He's grinding then.
Yeah. He texted me right before we started with you. He's like, well, if we're doing that second one, he goes, I still got Abby. I'm holding her right now. I don't think I'm going to make it. I don't think I'm going to make it on. So it's so he's kind of hit or miss. But yeah, it's just you got to do what's manageable. You got to do what you enjoy doing, and that's what we've been able to do. And it's been a lot of fun. And you're doing a great job with yours. And I like the breakdowns of pulling out little smaller clips and things. I do think that there's value in that. We've thought about doing that at various points and. It's just like you kind of pick and choose of, okay, how much time do I have to edit that, get it uploaded and put that together and do this and that. And we're like, yeah, I don't know if we're going to do that. But we've got to just, you know, you figure out what works and then you just roll with it and see what happens. So that's kind of what
it obviously works. It obviously works the way you're doing it because of not just the people you've had on, but the fact that, I mean, it appears as if, you know, you're not being told no a bunch. Like people are typically pretty willing to come on and share. They're excited about it. You know what? What's fun that you have is a co-host where you guys can do some episodes just together. And you know, I thought at times about because we had talked about social media a little bit, and you didn't know if what you're doing was good or bad. I think how consistent you are with it is always that's always a good thing.
I agree with that. And
I think I do struggle a little bit with that with the social media piece, and also too because I'm so small, like I'm not seeing really anything from it, but I won't until I get it's a long grind
to build even a small loyal audience. that takes a long time. And to build your social media following takes a long, long time. And then even when you get to a point, and like our social media is fine, whatever, we have like, I don't know, 4,500 followers on Twitter, which is great, but it's not like mind blowing. And yet part of me is like, well, what does that do for us or not do for us as far as the number of downloads? And then ultimately it's like, well, what do the downloads mean? Yeah, they mean, you know, I can go and talk to a potential sponsor or advertiser and give them the downloads. But in a lot of cases, I barely understand what the numbers mean. I've been doing this for 4 years. So when you go to somebody, you say, hey, we're getting X number of downloads. And they're like, well, okay, great. What does that mean? And I could say, well, it means this. And they're like, okay, well. So it's just, I think ultimately.
It's such a weird world. Yeah.
It really is. And I think what you have to do is you just have to do it because you love doing it. And I think in your situation where you're doing it, where you're learning and growing in your job as a head coach, that just adds a whole nother layer of value to it. So it's been a blast. I'm super appreciative of everybody that's come on, and I just it's been so much fun.
I got a question for you. Like, I'm sure you feel the same way about, you hear so much great information from such wise people, and how do you choose what you implement, like what, because you only have so much room. I actually was at our church last night. There's a speaker that came in on Wednesday night and was, he talked about the wisdom pyramid, and that's what the book is called. And it's kind of a cool concept. It's like the food pyramid, but where wisdom, how it should come and where it comes and how most of, like, the cell phone and social media and everything should be at the very top, where sugar and sweets are in the food pyramid, but it's flipped for most of us, where it's just a information overload, you know, that we have so much coming in. So that was fascinating. Right. But then it made me even think, so I've started to go back through and listen to each episode again, taking notes over the, without, you know, golden nuggets or the big action items from it. But it's almost like it's too much. So how do you, with like all of your episodes, I mean, I'm assuming there's some that are just going to kind of fade a little bit, like you just don't really revisit it. But like, yeah, well, how are you choosing what you take in and what you kind of just don't?
That's a great question. So I think I would answer that in two parts. So one is that I've never been great about implementing something as a coach and then sticking with it for a long time. Like, I'm like, ooh, let me try that. And I'll do that for 3 weeks or a month. And then I'll be like, oh, all right, let me try this. That sounds cool. Let me do this. And so I've been, I think, notorious for kind of jumping from one thing to another. So I am a person that I'll hear something and I'll be like, oh, I want to try that. Or let me see if that'll work, and I'll try it, and then I'll get distracted by the next thing. So I'm probably not the right person to talk about how to best implement any of these things. So there's that piece of it. And then I think the second bigger piece of it is I've thought about trying to figure how could I take, because there are definitely themes that have run through when I think about the episodes, when you talk about how coaches have had success and what they've been able to do.
Yeah.
There's definitely themes over the course of the whatever 400 and some, you know, coaching interview episodes that we've done that are, I don't want to say universal truths, but just things that have come up over and over again with whatever, 70%, 80%, 90% of the coaches.
You probably have a book.
Yeah. So that's part of, and then when I think about writing a book, I'm like, where am I fitting that? Where am I fitting that into my current life? But I do think that there's a book here. So I did at one point about 6 months ago, I started to try to categorize and come up with those themes and then start to go back and think about episodes where coaches talked about it. But it's almost so daunting now because we have so many episodes to go back and find those sound bites and clips and figure out exactly where those are it almost seems, it seems rather daunting. But I do think there's a book in there, and I have thought about it, and I do think that the collective wisdom of the people that we've had on would make a really good book. It's just a matter of finding the time and the wherewithal to be able to do that. So,
all right. So I'm an idea guy too. What do you think of this? Because right, I love the Tim Ferriss book, Tools of Titans.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Like to me, that's the blueprint for.
Yeah, I agree.
Because I think I like your idea of everything that you've had. Like you could almost like a Kevin Eastman type of why the best of the best. Kind of like that, like go through and find some themes. Like you could definitely do that.
For sure.
I don't have, and when I mean another book in me, like I struggle to write The Leftovers. And so that's just not something that is a gift. I don't feel like it's a gift
once
of mine.
Once is enough.
Once is enough. You know, like everybody has a story in their life. Like that's mine. And so I'm not just going to make up another one. And then, but I did think, like, as a coach, you know, I love free stuff. I will almost put my email in any mailer if they say, well, they'll send you a free PDF of something. And so I love that. And I thought, okay, I don't really know what to do with these episodes after they're done. And unfortunately, I didn't do a season thing. I just started. And because I do believe in consistency, like I don't see an end date. I don't see a pause date. So I think I'll have, you know, years and then another year. And so I thought of like Jamoti tools for coaches, something like that. I like the just a matter of doing it term is
right.
I stole that in seventh grade from a coach at a camp that kept saying it. And he finally told us what it meant. And I named my personal workout Jamoti as a junior high kid. So it's always been kind of this mantra, just a matter of doing it with anything in life. And then with the podcast, it just made sense. But I thought about that Jamoti tools for coaches or Jamoti tools or something where it's season one or year one. And then it's a Tools of Titan-esque where it's the episode, but like I'm looking at Kelvin Sampson's right now in my notebook, and it's four pages of just unbelievable nuggets. You know, don't try to eliminate your failures. Learn from them. It's okay to fail. Like you just, if I wanted to kind of gift wrap, you know, the first year to these coaches, here are the golden nuggets and, you know, action steps or maybe a shooting game and kind of put that in there. I think that would, again, if we're just trying to add value or bring value to people, but then it's like, do I do an ebook with it? Is it just a PDF? Is it just like all the that stuff? I don't think I want to go down the publisher route again because that's always fun. And so I don't know, man.
Yeah, it's there's so many potential offshoots of things that I've considered over time. And for me, it always comes down to when I look at what we're doing now and I think about, okay, what are the things that we could do that sort of spring off naturally from this? And we've had ideas and thoughts and conversations, and it continuously comes back to how much time do you have to dedicate to something that, as my wife likes to say, come on, Mike, it's just a hobby. So it's, you know, it's interesting and it's a lot of fun. Yeah. And, you know, we're going to keep doing it and who knows where it goes. So that being said, we are at, I don't even know what the time, I'm not even on our recording screen anymore. We're at like 2 hours. So this
two
might be
hours and 8 minutes, 2 hours, it's and only 8 minutes, but I can keep
only
going. I
mean, it's only 2:01 a.m. here where I'm sitting. So
I mean, we really haven't talked about some of the good stuff like the leftovers, the largest tragedy or scandal in college basketball history.
Yeah, that's going to be you're going to come back on and we're going to talk about that because I definitely want to compare. I didn't deal with anything anywhere near what you had to deal with, but just the era of college basketball, I was 88 to 92. So you were a little bit after me, but I think there's a lot of similarities in terms of just the experience of what it's like to play Division One basketball. And I think a lot of people that are out there maybe don't always have a good understanding of really what what all it entails. So I think that's a podcast in and of itself. So all that being said, why don't we do this? You share how people can get in touch with you, reach out to you, find out more about you and your program, social media, email, whatever you want to share, website, and then I'll jump back in, wrap things up, and then we will make plans off air to get you back on.
Okay. Yeah. And first of all, just thank you so much for allowing me to come on. Based on the names that you've had, I don't feel qualified 100%, but then I love that about this game too, is just that from, you know, people far away, there's commonality in the fact that we love the game and we love to share and talk hoops. And anybody, if there's anything today that made you think, especially about shooting, maybe running and gunning, if you want to talk to me about rebounding games and defense, I may not be your guy. I get that. But the other side of it is fun for me. Social media, it's just at Matt_Saman, S-A-Y-M-A-N. And then email, just saman.matt@gmail.com. Will be great. I'll tell you this. So since I did go more into depth with the Jamoni skill rating, I'm working on just on my phone filming it, filmed my stepson going through it. I'm going to put it together with some voiceover with the rules. And I think I'm going to start sharing it with some people that want it, because it's been such a great tool for me over the years like that coach said, like quit holding on to it. And so if anybody would like that, it may not be ready. Like if you email me tomorrow, it's not ready, but I'll get it to you. And hopefully you can play with it and adjust it. And it's been really fun.
Matt, cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule. It's been an absolute pleasure having this conversation, and definitely we'll look forward to getting you back on and talking some Baylor basketball and your time there and your book, The Leftovers. And again, it's just been a complete pleasure. I want to say thanks to Matt McLeod for connecting us. That's one of the things that I think is super important here on the pod, is to recognize the fact that our previous guests oftentimes are the ones that make the connections for us to get our new guests on. So thanks to Matt. Thanks to you, Matt, for jumping on tonight. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.